The north wind ceased to blow, and the Greek ships sailed out over a quiet sea. But the evil price they had paid was bound someday to bring evil down upon them. When they reached the mouth of the Simois, one of the rivers of Troy, the first man to leap ashore was Protesilaus. It was a brave deed, for the oracle had said that he who landed first would be the first to die. Therefore, when he had fallen by a Trojan spear, the Greeks paid him honors as though he were divine, and the gods too greatly distinguished him. They had Hermes bring him up from the dead to see once again his deeply mourning wife, Laodamia. She would not give him up a second time, however. When he went back to the underworld, she went with him. She killed herself. The 1,000 ships carried a great host of fighting men, and the Greek army was very strong. But the Trojan city was strong, too. Priam, the king, and his queen Hecuba had many brave sons to lead the attack and to defend the walls. One, above all, Hector, than whom no man anywhere was nobler or more brave, and only one a greater warrior, the champion of the Greeks, Achilles. Each knew that he would die before Troy was taken. Achilles had been told by his mother, "Very brief is your lot. Would that you could be free now from tears and troubles, for you shall not long endure, my child, short-lived beyond all men and to be pitied." No divinity had told Hector, but he was equally sure. "I know well in my heart and in my soul," he said to his wife Andromache, "the day shall come when holy Troy will be laid low, and Priam's people." Both heroes fought under the shadow of certain death. For 9 years, victory wavered, now to this side, now to that. Neither was ever able to gain any decided advantage. Then a quarrel flared up between two Greeks, Achilles and Agamemnon, and for a time it turned the tide in favor of the Trojans. Again, a woman was the reason, Chryseis, daughter of Apollo's priest, whom the Greeks had carried off and given to Agamemnon. Her father came to beg for her release, but Agamemnon would not let her go. Then the priest prayed to the mighty god he served, and Phoebus Apollo heard him. From his sun chariot, he shot fiery arrows down upon the Greek army, and men sickened and died, so that funeral pyres were burning continually. At last Achilles called an assembly of the chieftains. He told them that they could not hold out against both the pestilence and the Trojans, and that they must either find a way to appease Apollo or else sail home. Then the prophet Calchas stood up and said he knew why the god was angry, but that he was afraid to speak unless Achilles would guarantee his safety. "I do so," Achilles answered, "even if you accuse Agamemnon himself." Every man there understood what that meant. They knew how Apollo's priest had been treated. When Calchas declared that Chryseis must be given back to her father, he had all the chiefs behind him, and Agamemnon, greatly angered, was obliged to agree. "But if I lose her who was my prize of honor," he told Achilles, "I will have another in her stead." Therefore, when Chryseis had been returned to her father, Agamemnon sent two of his squires to Achilles' tent to take his prize of honor away from him, the maiden Briseis. Most unwillingly they went, and stood before the hero in heavy silence. But he, knowing their errand, told them it was not they who were wronging him. "Let them take the girl without fear for themselves, but hear him first, while he swore before gods and men that Agamemnon would pay dearly for the deed." That night, Achilles' mother, silver-footed Thetis, the sea nymph, came to him. She was as angry as he. She told him to have nothing more to do with the Greeks, And with that, she went up to heaven and asked Zeus to give success to the Trojans. Zeus was very reluctant. The war, by now, had reached Olympus. The gods were ranged against each other. Aphrodite, of course, was on the side of Paris. Equally, of course, Hera and Athena were against him. Ares, god of war, always took sides with Aphrodite, while Poseidon, lord of the sea, favored the Greeks, a sea people, always great sailors. Apollo cared for Hector, and for his sake helped the Trojans, and Artemis, as his sister, did so too. Zeus liked the Trojans best, on the whole, but he wanted to be neutral, because Hera was so disagreeable whenever he opposed her openly. However, he could not resist Thetis. He had a hard time with Hera, who guessed, as she usually did, what he was about. He was driven, finally, into telling her that he would lay hands upon her if she did not stop talking. Hera kept silence then, but her thoughts were busy as to how she might help the Greeks and circumvent Zeus. The plan Zeus made was simple. He knew that the Greeks, without Achilles, were inferior to the Trojans, and he sent a lying dream to Agamemnon, promising him victory if he attacked. While Achilles stayed in his tent, a fierce battle followed, the hardest yet fought. Up on the wall of Troy, the old king Priam and the other old men, wise in the ways of war, sat watching the contest. To them came Helen, the cause of all that agony and death, yet as they looked at her, they could not feel any blame. "Men must fight for such as she," they said to each other, for her face was like to that of an immortal spirit. She stayed by them, telling them the names of this and that Greek hero, until, to their astonishment, the battle ceased. The armies drew back on either side, and in the space between, Paris and Menelaus faced each other. It was evident that the sensible decision had been reached to let the two most concerned fight it out alone. Paris struck first, but Menelaus caught the swift spear on his shield, then hurled his own. It rent Paris's tunic, but did not wound him. Menelaus drew his sword, his only weapon now, but as he did so, it fell from his hand, broken. Undaunted, though unarmed, he leaped upon Paris, and seizing him by his helmet's crest, swung him off his feet. He would have dragged him to the Greeks victoriously, if it had not been for Aphrodite. She tore away the strap that kept the helmet on, so that it came away in Menelaus's hand. Paris himself, who had not fought at all except to throw his spear, she caught up in a cloud and took back to Troy. Furiously, Menelaus went through the Trojan ranks seeking Paris, and not a man there but would have helped him, for they all hated Paris, but he was gone, no one knew how or where. So Agamemnon spoke to both armies, declaring that Menelaus was victor, and bidding the Trojans give Helen back. This was just, and the Trojans would have agreed, if Athena, at Hera's prompting, had not interfered. Hera was determined that the war should not end until Troy was ruined. Athena, sweeping down to the battlefield, persuaded the foolish heart of Pandarus, a Trojan, to break the truce and shoot an arrow at Menelaus. He did so, and wounded him, only slightly, but the Greeks, in rage at the treachery, turned upon the Trojans, and the battle was on again. Terror and destruction and strife, whose fury never slackens, all friends of the murderous war god, were there to urge men on to slaughter each other. Then the voice of groaning was heard, and the voice of triumph from slayer and from slain, and the earth steamed with blood. On the Greek side, with Achilles gone, the two greatest champions were Ajax and Diomedes. They fought gloriously that day, and many a Trojan lay on his face in the dust before them. The best and bravest, next to Hector, the prince Aeneas, came near to death at Diomedes' hands. He was of more than royal blood. His mother was Aphrodite herself, and when Diomedes wounded him, she hastened down to the battlefield to save him. She lifted him in her soft arms, but Diomedes, knowing she was a coward goddess, not one of those who, like Athena, are masters where warriors fight, leaped toward her and wounded her hand. Crying out, she let Aeneas fall, and weeping for pain, made her way to Olympus, where Zeus, smiling to see the laughter-loving goddess in tears, bade her stay away from battle and remember hers were the works of love and not of war. But although his mother failed him, Aeneas was not killed. Apollo enveloped him in a cloud and carried him to sacred Pergamos, the holy place of Troy, where Artemis healed him of his wound. But Diomedes raged on, working havoc in the Trojan ranks until he came face to face with Hector. There, to his dismay, he saw Ares too. The blood-stained murderous god of war was fighting for Hector. At the sight, Diomedes shuddered and cried to the Greeks to fall back, slowly, however, and with their faces toward the Trojans. Then Hera was angry. She urged her horses to Olympus and asked Zeus if she might drive that bane of men, Ares, from the battlefield. Zeus, who loved him no more than Hera did, even though he was their son, willingly gave her leave. She hastened down to stand beside Diomedes and urge him to smite the terrible god and have no fear. At that, joy filled the hero's heart. He rushed at Ares and hurled his spear at him. Athena drove it home, and it entered Ares' body. The war god bellowed as loud as 10,000 cry in battle, and at the awful sound, trembling seized the whole host, Greeks and Trojans alike. Ares, really a bully at heart, and unable to bear what he brought upon unnumbered multitudes of men, fled up to Zeus in Olympus and complained bitterly of Athena's violence. But Zeus looked at him sternly and told him he was as intolerable as his mother and bade him cease his whining. With Ares gone, however, the Trojans were forced to fall back. At this crisis, a brother of Hector's, wise in discerning the will of the gods, urged Hector to go with all speed to the city and tell the queen, his mother, to offer to Athena the most beautiful robe she owned and pray her to have mercy. Hector felt the wisdom of the advice and sped through the gates to the palace, where his mother did all as he said. She took a robe so precious that it shone like a star, and laying it on the goddess's knees, she besought her, "Lady Athena, spare the city, and the wives of the Trojans, and the little children." But Pallas Athena denied the prayer. As Hector went back to the battle, he turned aside to see once more, perhaps for the last time, the wife he tenderly loved, Andromache, and his son, Astyanax. He met her on the wall where she had gone in terror to watch the fighting when she heard the Trojans were in retreat. With her was a handmaid carrying the little boy. Hector smiled and looked at them silently, but Andromache took his hand in hers and wept. "My dear lord," she said, "you who are father and mother and brother unto me as well as husband, stay here with us. Do not make me a widow and your child an orphan." He refused her gently. He could not be a coward, he said. It was for him to fight always in the forefront of the battle. Yet she could know that he never forgot what her anguish would be when he died. That was the thought that troubled him above all else, more than his many other cares. He turned to leave her, but first he held out his arms to his son. Terrified, the little boy shrank back, afraid of the helmet and its fierce, nodding crest. Hector laughed and took the shining helmet from his head. Then, holding the child in his arms, he caressed him and prayed, "O Zeus, in after years may men say of this my son, when he returns from battle, far greater is he than his father was." So he laid the boy in his wife's arms, and she took him, smiling, yet with tears. And Hector pitied her, and touched her tenderly with his hand, and spoke to her, "Dear one, be not so sorrowful. That which is fated must come to pass. But against my fate, no man can kill me." Then taking up his helmet, he left her, and she went to her house, often looking back at him and weeping bitterly. Once again on the battlefield, he was eager for the fight, and better fortune for a time lay before him. Zeus had by now remembered his promise to Thetis to avenge Achilles' wrong. He ordered all the other immortals to stay in Olympus. He himself went down to earth to help the Trojans. Then it went hard with the Greeks. Their great champion was far away. Achilles sat alone in his tent, brooding over his wrongs. The great Trojan champion had never before shown himself so brilliant and so brave. Hector seemed irresistible. Tamer of horses, the Trojans always called him, and he drove his car through the Greek ranks as if the same spirit animated steeds and driver. His glancing helm was everywhere, and one gallant warrior after another fell beneath his terrible bronze spear. When evening ended the battle, the Trojans had driven the Greeks back almost to their ships. There was rejoicing in Troy that night, but grief and despair in the Greek camp. Agamemnon himself was all for giving up and sailing back to Greece. Nestor, however, who was the oldest among the chieftains, and therefore the wisest, wiser even than the shrewd Odysseus, spoke out boldly and told Agamemnon that if he had not angered Achilles, they would not have been defeated. "Try to find some way of appeasing him," he said, "instead of going home disgraced." All applauded the advice, and Agamemnon confessed that he had acted like a fool. He would send Briseis back, he promised them, and with her many other splendid gifts, and he begged Odysseus to take his offer to Achilles. Odysseus and the two chieftains chosen to accompany him found the hero with his friend Patroclus, who of all men on earth was dearest to him. Achilles welcomed them courteously and set food and drink before them, but when they told him why they had come and all the rich gifts that would be his if he would yield, and begged him to have pity on his hard-pressed countrymen, they received an absolute refusal. "Not all the treasures of Egypt could buy him," he told them. "He was sailing home, and they would be wise to do the same." But all rejected that counsel when Odysseus brought back the answer. The next day, they went into battle with the desperate courage of brave men cornered. Again they were driven back, until they stood fighting on the beach where their ships were drawn up. But help was at hand. Hera had laid her plans. She saw Zeus sitting on Mount Ida watching the Trojans conquer, and she thought how she detested him. But she knew well that she could get the better of him only in one way. She must go to him looking so lovely that he could not resist her. When he took her in his arms, she would pour sweet sleep upon him, and he would forget the Trojans. So she did. She went to her chamber and used every art she knew to make herself beautiful beyond compare. Last of all, she borrowed Aphrodite's girdle, wherein were all her enchantments, and with this added charm, she appeared before Zeus. As he saw her, love overcame his heart, so that he thought no more of his promise to Thetis. At once, the battle turned in favor of the Greeks. Ajax hurled Hector to the ground, although before he could wound him, Aeneas lifted him and bore him away. With Hector gone, the Greeks were able to drive the Trojans far back from the ships, and Troy might have been sacked that very day if Zeus had not awakened. He leaped up and saw the Trojans in flight and Hector lying gasping on the plain. All was clear to him, and he turned fiercely to Hera. "This was her doing," he said, "her crafty, crooked ways." He was half-minded to give her then and there a beating. When it came to that kind of fighting, Hera knew she was helpless. She promptly denied that she had had anything to do with the Trojans' defeat. "It was all Poseidon," she said. And indeed, the sea god had been helping the Greeks, contrary to Zeus's orders, but only because she had begged him. However, Zeus was glad enough of an excuse not to lay hands on her. He sent her back to Olympus and summoned Iris, the rainbow messenger, to carry his command to Poseidon to withdraw from the field. Sullenly, the sea god obeyed, and once more the tide of battle turned against the Greeks. Apollo had revived the fainting Hector and breathed into him surpassing power. Before the two, the god and the hero, the Greeks were like a flock of frightened sheep driven by mountain lions. They fled in confusion to the ships, and the wall they had built to defend them went down like a sand wall children heap up on the shore and then scatter in their play. The Trojans were almost near enough to set the ships on fire. The Greeks, hopeless, thought only of dying bravely. Patroclus, Achilles' beloved friend, saw the rout with horror. Not even for Achilles' sake could he stay longer away from the battle. "You can keep your wrath while your countrymen go down in ruin," he cried to Achilles. "I cannot. Give me your armor. If they think I am you, the Trojans may pause, and the worn-out Greeks have a breathing space. You and I are fresh. We might yet drive back the enemy. But if you will sit nursing your anger, at least let me have the armor." As he spoke, one of the Greek ships burst into flame. "That way they can cut off the army's retreat," Achilles said. "Go, take my armor, my men too, and defend the ships." "I cannot go. I am a man dishonored. For my own ships, if the battle comes near them, I will fight. I will not fight for men who have disgraced me." So Patroclus put on the splendid armor all the Trojans knew and feared, and led the Myrmidons, Achilles' men, to the battle. At the first onset of this new band of warriors, the Trojans wavered. They thought Achilles led them on. And indeed, for a time, Patroclus fought as gloriously as that great hero himself could have done. But at last, he met Hector face to face. And his doom was sealed, as surely as a boar is doomed when he faces a lion. Hector's spear gave him a mortal wound, and his soul fled from his body down to the house of Hades. Then Hector stripped his armor from him, and, casting his own aside, put it on. It seemed as though he had taken on, too, Achilles' strength, and no man of the Greeks could stand before him. Evening came that puts an end to battle. Achilles sat by his tent, waiting for Patroclus to return. But instead, he saw old Nestor's son running toward him, fleet-footed Antilochus. He was weeping hot tears as he ran. "Bitter tidings," he cried out. "Patroclus is fallen, and Hector has his armor." Grief took hold of Achilles, so black that those around him feared for his life. Down in the sea caves, his mother knew his sorrow and came up to try to comfort him. "I will no longer live among men," he told her, "if I do not make Hector pay with his death for Patroclus dead." Then Thetis, weeping, bade him remember that he himself was fated to die straightway after Hector. "So may I do," Achilles answered, "I, who did not help my comrade in his sore need. I will kill the destroyer of him I loved. Then I will accept death when it comes. Thetis did not attempt to hold him back. Only wait until morning, she said, and you will not go unarmed to battle. I will bring you arms fashioned by the divine armorer, the god Hephaestus himself. Marvelous arms they were when Thetis brought them, worthy of their maker, such as no man on earth had ever borne. The Myrmidons gazed at them with awe, and a flame of fierce joy blazed in Achilles' eyes as he put them on. Then, at last, he left the tent in which he had sat so long, and went down to where the Greeks were gathered, a wretched company. Diomedes, grievously wounded, Odysseus, Agamemnon, and many another. He felt shame before them, and he told them he saw his own exceeding folly in allowing the loss of a mere girl to make him forget everything else. But that was over. He was ready to lead them as before. Let them prepare at once for the battle. The chieftains applauded joyfully. But Odysseus spoke for all when he said they must first take their fill of food and wine, for fasting men made poor fighters. Our comrades lie dead on the field, and you call to food? Achilles answered scornfully. Down my throat shall go neither bite nor sup until my dear comrade is avenged. And to himself he said, Oh, dearest of friends, for want of you, I cannot eat, I cannot drink. When the others had satisfied their hunger, he led the attack. This was the last fight between the two great champions, as all the immortals knew. They also knew how it would turn out. Father Zeus hung his golden balances and set in one the lot of Hector's death, and in the other, that of Achilles. Hector's lot sank down. It was appointed that he should die. Nevertheless, the victory was long in doubt. The Trojans under Hector fought as brave men fight before the walls of their home. Even the great river of Troy, which the gods call Xanthus and men Scamander, took part and strove to drown Achilles as he crossed its waters. In vain, for nothing could check him as he rushed on, slaughtering all in his path and seeking everywhere for Hector. The gods by now were fighting too, as hotly as the men, and Zeus, sitting apart in Olympus, laughed pleasantly to himself when he saw God matched against God, Athena felling Ares to the ground, Hera seizing the bow of Artemis from her shoulders and boxing her ears with it, this way and that, Poseidon provoking Apollo with taunting words to strike him first. The sun god refused the challenge. He knew it was of no use now to fight for Hector. By this time, the gates, the great Scaean gates of Troy, had been flung wide, for the Trojans at last were in full flight and were crowding into the town. Only Hector stood immovable before the wall. From the gates, old Priam, his father, and his mother Hecuba, cried to him to come within and save himself, but he did not heed. He was thinking, I led the Trojans. Their defeat is my fault. Then am I to spare myself? And yet, what if I were to lay down shield and spear and go tell Achilles that we will give Helen back and half of Troy's treasures with her? Useless. He would but kill me unarmed, as if I were a woman. Better to join battle with him now, even if I die. On came Achilles, glorious as the sun when he rises. Beside him was Athena. But Hector was alone. Apollo had left him to his fate. As the pair drew near, he turned and fled. Three times around the wall of Troy, pursued and pursuer ran with flying feet. It was Athena who made Hector halt. She appeared beside him in the shape of his brother, Deiphobus. And with this ally, as he thought, Hector faced Achilles. He cried out to him, "If I kill you, I will give back your body to your friends, and do you do the same to me?" But Achilles answered, "Madman, there are no covenants between sheep and wolves, nor between you and me." So saying, he hurled his spear. It missed its aim, but Athena brought it back. Then Hector struck with a true aim. The spear hit the center of Achilles' shield. But to what good? That armor was magical and could not be pierced. He turned quickly to Deiphobus to get his spear, but he was not there. Then Hector knew the truth. Athena had tricked him, and there was no way of escape. "The gods have summoned me to death," he thought. "At least I will not die without a struggle, but in some great deed of arms which men yet to be born will tell each other." He drew his sword, his only weapon now, and rushed upon his enemy. But Achilles had a spear, the one Athena had recovered for him. Before Hector could approach, he who knew well that armor taken by Hector from the dead Patroclus aimed at an opening in it near the throat and drove the spear point in. Hector fell, dying at last. With his last breath, he prayed, "Give back my body to my father and my mother." "No prayers from you to me, you dog," Achilles answered. "I would that I could make myself devour raw your flesh for the evil you have brought upon me." Then Hector's soul flew forth from his body and was gone to Hades, bewailing his fate, leaving vigor and youth behind. Achilles stripped the bloody armor from the corpse, while the Greeks ran up to wonder how tall he was as he lay there and how noble to look upon. But Achilles' mind was on other matters. He pierced the feet of the dead man and fastened them with thongs to the back of his chariot, letting the head trail. Then he lashed his horses, and round the walls of Troy he dragged all that was left of glorious Hector. At last, when his fierce soul was satisfied with vengeance, he stood beside the body of Patroclus and said, "Hear me, even in the house of Hades. I have dragged Hector behind my chariot, and I will give him to the dogs to devour beside your funeral pyre." Up in Olympus, there was dissension. This abuse of the dead displeased all the immortals, except Hera and Athena and Poseidon. Especially it displeased Zeus. He sent Iris to Priam to order him to go without fear to Achilles to redeem Hector's body, bearing a rich ransom. She was to tell him that, violent as Achilles was, he was not really evil, but one who would treat properly a suppliant. Then the aged king heaped a car with splendid treasures, the best in Troy, and went over the plain to the Greek camp. Hermes met him, looking like a Greek youth and offering himself as a guide to Achilles' tent. So accompanied, the old man passed the guards and came into the presence of the man who had killed and maltreated his son. He clasped his knees and kissed his hands, and as he did so, Achilles felt awe, and so did all the others there, looking strangely upon one another. "Remember, Achilles," Priam said, "your own father, of like years with me, and, like me, wretched for want of a son. Yet I am by far more to be pitied, who have braved what no man on earth ever did before, to stretch out my hand to the slayer of my son." Grief stirred within Achilles' heart as he listened. Gently he raised the old man. Sit by me here, he said, and let our sorrow lie quiet in our hearts. Evil is all men's lot, but yet we must keep courage. Then he bade his servants wash and anoint Hector's body, and cover it with a soft robe, so that Priam should not see it, frightfully mangled as it was, and be unable to keep back his wrath. He feared for his own self-control if Priam vexed him. How many days do you desire to make his funeral? He asked. For so long, I will keep the Greeks back from battle. Then Priam brought Hector home, mourned in Troy as never another. Even Helen wept. The other Trojans upbraid me, she said, but always I had comfort from you, through the gentleness of your spirit and your gentle words. You only were my friend. 9 days, they lamented him. Then they laid him on a lofty pyre and set fire to it. When all was burned, they quenched the flame with wine and gathered the bones into a golden urn, shrouding them in soft purple. They set the urn in a hollow grave and piled great stones over it. This was the funeral of Hector, tamer of horses. And with it, the Iliad ends. Chapter 14. The Fall of Troy. The greater part of this story comes from Virgil. The capture of Troy is the subject of the second book of the Aeneid, and it is one of the best, if not the best, story Virgil ever told. Concise, pointed, vivid. The beginning and the end of my account are not in Virgil. I have taken the story of Philoctetes and the death of Ajax from two plays of the 5th century tragic poet Sophocles. The end, the tale of what happened to the Trojan women when Troy fell, comes from a play by Sophocles' fellow playwright, Euripides. It is a curious contrast to the martial spirit of the Aeneid. To Virgil, as to all Roman poets, war was the noblest and most glorious of human activities. 400 years before Virgil, a Greek poet looked at it differently. What was the end of that far-famed war, Euripides seems to ask? Just this: a ruined town, a dead baby, a few wretched women. With Hector dead, Achilles knew, as his mother had told him, that his own death was near. One more great feat of arms he did before his fighting ended forever. Prince Memnon of Ethiopia, the son of the goddess of the dawn, came to the assistance of Troy with a large army. And for a time, even though Hector was gone, the Greeks were hard-pressed and lost many a gallant warrior, including swift-footed Antilochus, old Nestor's son. Finally, Achilles killed Memnon in a glorious combat, the Greek hero's last battle. Then he himself fell beside the Scaean gates. He had driven the Trojans before him up to the wall of Troy. There, Paris shot an arrow at him, and Apollo guided it so that it struck his foot in the one spot where he could be wounded, his heel. His mother, Thetis, when he was born, had intended to make him invulnerable by dipping him into the river Styx. But she was careless and did not see to it that the water covered the part of the foot by which she was holding him. He died, and Ajax carried his body out of the battle, while Odysseus held the Trojans back. It is said that after he had been burned on the funeral pyre, his bones were placed in the same urn that held those of his friend Patroclus. His arms, those marvelous arms Thetis had brought him from Hephaestus, caused the death of Ajax. It was decided, in full assembly, that the heroes who best deserved them were Ajax and Odysseus. A secret vote was then taken between the two, and Odysseus got the arms. Such a decision was a very serious matter in those days. It was not only that the man who won was honored, the man who was defeated was held to be dishonored. Ajax saw himself disgraced, and in a fit of furious anger, he determined to kill Agamemnon and Menelaus. He believed, and with reason, that they had turned the vote against him. At nightfall, he went to find them, and he had reached their quarters when Athena struck him with madness. He thought the flocks and herds of the Greeks were the army, and rushed to kill them, believing that he was slaying now this chieftain, now that. Finally, he dragged to his tent a huge ram, which to his distracted mind was Odysseus, bound him to the tent pole, and beat him savagely. Then his frenzy left him. He regained his reason, and saw that his disgrace in not winning the arms had been but a shadow, as compared with the same his own deeds had drawn down upon him. His rage, his folly, his madness would be apparent to everyone. The slaughtered animals were lying all over the field. "The poor cattle," he said to himself, "killed to no purpose by my hand. And I stand here alone, hateful to men and to gods. In such a state, only a coward clings to life. A man, if he cannot live nobly, can die nobly." He drew his sword and killed himself. The Greeks would not burn his body. They buried him. They held that a suicide should not be honored with a funeral pyre and urn burial. His death, following so soon upon Achilles, dismayed the Greeks. Victory seemed as far off as ever. Their prophet, Calchas, told them that he had no message from the gods for them, but that there was a man among the Trojans who knew the future, the prophet Helenus. If they captured him, they could learn from him what they should do. Odysseus succeeded in making him a prisoner, and he told the Greeks Troy would not fall until someone fought against the Trojans with the bow and arrows of Hercules. These had been given, when Hercules died, to the prince Philoctetes, the man who had fired his funeral pyre, and who later had joined the Greek host when they sailed to Troy. On the voyage, the Greeks stopped at an island to offer a sacrifice, and Philoctetes was bitten by a serpent, a most frightful wound. It would not heal. It was impossible to carry him to Troy as he was. The army could not wait. They left him, finally, at Lemnos, then an uninhabited island, although once the heroes of the quest of the Golden Fleece had found plenty of women there. It was cruel to desert the helpless sufferer, but they were desperate to get on to Troy, and with his bow and arrows, he would at least never lack for food. When Helenus spoke, however, the Greeks knew well that it would be hard to persuade him whom they had so wronged to give his precious weapons to them. So they sent Odysseus, the master of crafty cunning, to get them by trickery. Some say that Diomedes went with him, and others Neoptolemus, also called Pyrrhus, the young son of Achilles. They succeeded in stealing the bow and arrows, but when it came to leaving the poor wretch alone there, deprived of them, they could not do it. In the end, they persuaded him to go with them. Back at Troy, the wise physician of the Greeks healed him. And when at last he went joyfully once again into battle, the first man he wounded with his arrows was Paris. As he fell, Paris begged to be carried to Oenone, the nymph he had lived with on Mount Ida before the three goddesses came to him. She had told him that she knew a magic drug to cure any ailment. They took him to her, and he asked her for his life, but she refused. His desertion of her, his long forgetfulness, could not be forgiven in a moment because of his need. She watched him die. Then she went away and killed herself. Troy did not fall because Paris was dead. he was indeed no great loss. At last, the Greeks learned that there was a most sacred image of Pallas Athena in the city, called the Palladium, and that as long as the Trojans had it, Troy could not be taken. Accordingly, the two greatest of the chieftains left alive by then, Odysseus and Diomedes, determined to try to steal it. Diomedes was the one who bore the image off. In a dark night, he climbed the wall with Odysseus's help, found the Palladium, and took it to the camp. With this great encouragement, the Greeks determined to wait no longer, but devise some way to put an end to the endless war. They saw clearly by now that unless they could get their army into the city and take the Trojans by surprise, they would never conquer. Almost 10 years had passed since they had first laid siege to the town, and it seemed as strong as ever. The walls stood uninjured. They had never suffered a real attack. The fighting had taken place, for the most part, at a distance from them. The Greeks must find a secret way of entering the city, or accept defeat. The result of this new determination and new vision was the stratagem of the wooden horse. It was, as anyone would guess, the creation of Odysseus's wily mind. He had a skillful worker in wood make a huge wooden horse, which was hollow and so big that it could hold a number of men. Then he persuaded, and had a great difficulty in doing so, certain of the chieftains to hide inside it, along with himself, of course. They were all terror-stricken, except Achilles' son, Neoptolemus, and indeed what they faced was no slight danger. The idea was that all the other Greeks should strike camp and apparently put out to sea, but they would really hide beyond the nearest island where they could not be seen by the Trojans. Whatever happened, they would be safe. They could sail home if anything went wrong. But in that case, the men inside the wooden horse would surely die. Odysseus, as can be readily believed, had not overlooked this fact. His plan was to leave a single Greek behind in the deserted camp, primed with a tale calculated to make the Trojans draw the horse into the city, and without investigating it. Then, when night was darkest, the Greeks inside were to leave their wooden prison and open the city gates to the army, which by that time would have sailed back and be waiting before the wall. A night came when the plan was carried out. Then, the last day of Troy dawned. On the walls, the Trojan watchers saw with astonishment two sights, each as startling as the other. In front of the Scaean gates stood an enormous figure of a horse, such a thing as no one had ever seen, an apparition so strange that it was vaguely terrifying, even though there was no sound or movement coming from it. No sound or movement anywhere, indeed. The noisy Greek camp was hushed. Nothing was stirring there. And the ships were gone. Only one conclusion seemed possible. The Greeks had given up. They had sailed for Greece. They had accepted defeat. All Troy exulted. Her long warfare was over. Her sufferings lay behind her. The people flocked to the abandoned Greek camp to see the sights. Here Achilles had sulked so long. There Agamemnon's tent had stood. This was the quarters of the trickster Odysseus. What rapture to see the places empty! Nothing in them now to fear. At last they drifted back to where that monstrosity, the wooden horse, stood, and they gathered around it, puzzled what to do with it. Then, the Greek who had been left behind in the camp discovered himself to them. His name was Sinon, and he was a most plausible speaker. He was seized and dragged to Priam, weeping and protesting that he no longer wished to be a Greek. The story he told was one of Odysseus's masterpieces. Pallas Athena had been exceedingly angry, Sinon said, at the theft of the Palladium, and the Greeks, in terror, had sent to the oracle to ask how they could appease her. The oracle answered, "With blood, and with a maiden slain, you calmed the winds when first you came to Troy. With blood must your return be sought. With a Greek life, make expiation." He himself, Sinon told Priam, was the wretched victim chosen to be sacrificed. All was ready for the awful rite, which was to be carried out just before the Greeks' departure. But in the night, he had managed to escape, and, hidden in a swamp, had watched the ships sail away. It was a good tale, and the Trojans never questioned it. They pitied Sinon, and assured him that he should henceforth live as one of themselves. So it befell that by false cunning and pretended tears, those were conquered whom great Diomedes had never overcome, nor savage Achilles, nor 10 years of warfare, nor 1,000 ships. For Sinon did not forget the second part of his story. The wooden horse had been made, he said, as a votive offering to Athena, and the reason for its immense size was to discourage the Trojans from taking it into the city. What the Greeks hoped for was that the Trojans would destroy it, and so draw down upon them Athena's anger. Placed in the city, it would turn her favor to them and away from the Greeks. The story was clever enough to have had by itself, in all probability, the desired effect. But Poseidon, the most bitter of all the gods against Troy, contrived an addition which made the issue certain. The priest, Laocoon, when the horse was first discovered, had been urgent with the Trojans to destroy it. "I fear the Greeks, even when they bear gifts," he said. Cassandra, Priam's daughter, had echoed his warning, but no one ever listened to her, and she had gone back to the palace before Sinon appeared. Laocoon and his two sons heard his story with suspicion, the only doubters there. As Sinon finished, suddenly over the sea came 2 fearful serpents swimming to the land. Once there, they glided straight to Laocoon. They wrapped their huge coils around him and the 2 lads, and they crushed the life out of them. Then they disappeared within Athena's temple. There could be no further hesitation. To the horrified spectators, Laocoon had been punished for opposing the entry of the horse, which most certainly no one else would now do. All the people cried, "Bring the carven image in, bear it to Athena, fit gift for the child of Zeus. Who of the young but hurried forth? Who of the old would stay at home?" With song and rejoicing they brought death in, treachery and destruction. They dragged the horse through the gate and up to the temple of Athena. Then, rejoicing in their good fortune, believing the war ended and Athena's favor restored to them, they went to their houses in peace, as they had not for 10 years. In the middle of the night, the door in the horse opened. One by one, the chieftains let themselves down. They stole to the gates and threw them wide, and into the sleeping town marched the Greek army. What they had first to do could be carried out silently. Fires were started in buildings throughout the city. By the time the Trojans were awake, before they realized what had happened, while they were struggling into their armor, Troy was burning. They rushed out to the street one by one in confusion. Bands of soldiers were waiting there to strike each man down before he could join himself to others. It was not fighting, it was butchery. Very many died, without ever a chance of dealing a blow in return. In the more distant parts of the town, the Trojans were able to gather together here and there, and then it was the Greeks who suffered. They were borne down by desperate men who wanted only to kill before they were killed. They knew that the one safety for the conquered was to hope for no safety. This spirit often turned the victors into the vanquished. The quickest-witted Trojans tore off their own armor and put on that of the dead Greeks. And many a Greek, thinking he was joining friends, discovered, too late, that they were enemies, and paid for his error with his life. On top of the houses, they tore up the roofs and hurled the beams down upon the Greeks. An entire tower standing on the roof of Priam's palace was lifted from its foundations and toppled over. Exulting, the defenders saw it fall and annihilate a great band who were forcing the palace doors. But the success brought only a short respite. Others rushed up carrying a huge beam. Over the debris of the tower and the crushed bodies, they battered the doors with it. It crashed through, and the Greeks were in the palace before the Trojans could leave the roof. In the inner courtyard around the altar were the women and children, and one man, the old king. Achilles had spared Priam, but Achilles' son struck him down before the eyes of his wife and daughters. By now, the end was near. The contest from the first had been unequal. Too many Trojans had been slaughtered in the first surprise. The Greeks could not be beaten back anywhere. Slowly, the defense ceased. Before morning, all the leaders were dead, except one. Aphrodite's son, Aeneas, alone among the Trojan chiefs, escaped. He fought the Greeks as long as he could find a living Trojan to stand with him, but as the slaughter spread and death came near, he thought of his home, the helpless people he had left there. He could do nothing more for Troy, but perhaps something could be done for them. He hurried to them, his old father, his little son, his wife, and as he went, his mother Aphrodite appeared to him, urging him on and keeping him safe from the flames and from the Greeks. Even with the goddess's help, he could not save his wife. When they left the house, she got separated from him and was killed. But the other two he brought away, through the enemy, past the city gates, out into the country, his father on his shoulders, his son clinging to his hand. No one but a divinity could have saved them, and Aphrodite was the only one of the gods that day who helped a Trojan. She helped Helen, too. She got her out of the city and took her to Menelaus. He received her gladly, and as he sailed for Greece, she was with him. When morning came, what had been the proudest city in Asia was a fiery ruin. All that was left of Troy was a band of helpless, captive women, whose husbands were dead, whose children had been taken from them. They were waiting for their masters to carry them overseas to slavery. Chief among the captives was the old queen, Hecuba, and her daughter-in-law, Hector's wife, Andromache. For Hecuba, all was ended. Crouched on the ground, she saw the Greek ships getting ready, and she watched the city burn. "Troy is no longer," she told herself, "and I, who am I? A slave men drive like cattle, an old gray woman that has no home. What sorrow is there that is not mine? Country lost, and husband, and children, glory of all my house brought low." And the women around her answered, "We stand at the same point of pain. We are, too, slaves. Our children are crying, call to us with tears. Mother, I am all alone. To the dark ships now they drive me, and I cannot see you, mother." One woman still had her child. Andromache held in her arms her son Astyanax, the little boy who had once shrunk back from his father's high-crested helmet. "He is so young," she thought, "they will let me take him with me." But from the Greek camp a herald came to her and spoke faltering words. He told her that she must not hate him for the news he brought to her against his will. Her son, she broke in. Not that he does not go with me, he answered. The boy must die, be thrown